Mythos Busters, investigating the mystery, monsters, and madness of Arkham Horror, the card game.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Mythos Busters. I'm Sean. Fortunately, we have a bit of a shorter crew tonight, or smaller.
I'm the same height as I've always been.
Well, you know, so of course we have Nick.
Hi, guys.
And Ian.
Oh, boy.
And on a dark and Tomless night, we are also short Scott, who has officially joined the crew at this point. His schedule is just as erratic as Tom's, though, so we'll see if we can get him on the audio podcast regular more often, or whether he's just going to be kind of video and popping on the audio podcast when he can. So speaking of which, the first thing I want to tell you guys about is a new project that we have. It's called the Miskatonic AV Club, which I think we need to give credit where credit's due. Ian named that one as well as named the podcast proper here, so well done, Ian. So those Twitch and YouTube card reviews that we've been promising and talking about, well, we finally have the core set videos out there. So each one, because the core set is pretty huge. It ends up being about an hour for each class. So they're out there on YouTube. You can find that at youtube.com/mythosbusters. And we'll be continuing that series into the future with every new expansion that comes out, viewing those player cards. I thought it was a lot of fun. You guys think it turned out pretty well?
I think so.
It was cool. I enjoyed the little bit that I was able to make it for.
That sounded like trepidation, Ian, not confidence.
Yeah, I figured I'd let Scott's him answer first, since he was, you know, for most of it, but then his answer was a little less inspiring. So,
definitely check it out. It was a great time, fun, amazing. Change your life.
There you go. Perfect. So, let's bust right into this thing, guys. Tonight we're going to finally repeal the gag order. Oh, no, that's too real. We're going to lift the spoiler curtain on the core set. And honestly, I think I want to address this for a quick second as well. I think one of the most consistent pieces of constructive criticism that we've gotten for the podcast so far is that we are, or at least have been thus far, too careful about encounter card spoilers, gone too far to preserve the story. Now, that's always done, of course, with the idea to respect that the story is a huge part of the game. But at the same time, we don't want to be so careful that we're kind of making our conversation about encounter cards not relevant. So we're going to try to hit kind of a more happy medium here. We might engage in the occasional mechanical spoiler. If we ever talk about story stuff, like actual story stuff, we will preface it with a spoiler alert, so you can go ahead and just pause your recording real quick and come back when you've played said thing. But we'll try to do it in you know, some decent amount of, I guess, have a bit of a time lapse between when a product release and when we ever talk about legit spoilers for it. But going forward from here, core set spoilers are going to be fair game. So if you've not yet played the core set or are otherwise not okay with core set spoilers, go ahead and pause the podcast and hit us back again when you get there. So we're going to be talking about the Knight of the Zealot. And then we have a little bit of news as well. So let's do it. Ian, in Tom's absence, you want to walk us through the news?
Yeah, definitely. So our news item for the interim between last podcast and this one is the announcement of Undimensioned and Unseen, which is the fourth Mythos pack in the Dunwich Legacy cycle. As the article says, things are definitely getting weird. And apparently the weirdness is taking the form of strange extra-dimensional entities, which are apparently impervious and vulnerable to everything in your arsenal. So it looks like the pack is going to be focused on figuring out how to take down these things. And there is actually the encounter card in here that shows you how that's going to happen. Did we want to read that? I mean, it's part of the official article, right? That should be fair game for us to read.
So yeah, they spoiled it before we did. So
yes.
So if you are completely un-okay with any mechanical spoilers, here's a good point to pause.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and read this one. This is the Esoteric Formula, which is a story asset, zero cost. It's a spell for all you Agnes users in her signature asset. As an action, you trigger a fight action. This attack uses will instead of combat. You get +2 will for this attack for each clue on the attacked enemy. Use this ability only on an abomination enemy. Very interesting. So it sounds like there's going to be clues on the enemy.
Yeah, there's a lot in this card that's kind of suggested. So I guess we assume from the article that we can't just straight up hit them like we're, you know, damage them like we can normally. Is that about right?
That's what it sounds like. Do they say it's impervious? So
not only that, but they're going to, through some game mechanic, gain clues, which I'm trying to think if we've seen any enemies do that yet at this point. I don't think so.
Not in this game, at least. I know, I think in Arkham Horror, the board game, there's enemies that stack clues, but...
And that was one interesting thing, is the past few, at least, you know, Thrones I'm thinking of, Netrunner did it. Some of the other LCGs have kind of mechanical only tokens, where they're just generic tokens, and then you put them on a card when they tell you to, and then the card tells you what kind of tokens they are. This is a poison token for Tears of Lease, or this is a, you know, whatever token in Netrunner. And this game doesn't have that, so I guess that kind of looks like we'll be having clue tokens on enemies.
Mm-hmm. Which I think fits, whatever it's signifying. Fits how other Arkham file games have done it, because like I said, Arkham Horror, the board game, and Eldritch Horror, I think, does it too, where clues, yeah, it's the core of what you're trying to accomplish, but at the same time, they're also used to represent progress in general. And you have enemies that sometimes eat up progress, and you have, you know, things that you have to stack that on or accumulate it on, other than just spending it to move the plot or move whatever you're trying to do forward. So I think that makes sense.
It also reminds me of like those classic video game bosses where you have to figure out their weakness before you can actually do damage to them. So I like that aspect.
Also, a fun thing to note too is the flavor text, Negotium Perambulans in
Tenebria. Try that one again.
Nope, I'm not going to. I did it perfect the first time. That, according to Google Translate, is business that walketh in darkness. So I'm seeing an ancient one in some sort of like three-piece business suit. He's carrying a briefcase. He's got stuff to do.
Oh my God, guys, it's the silence. They're finally come through.
Yep. Sounds like it.
Nick doesn't watch Doctor Who. He didn't get that reference.
No, I do not watch the Doctor Who. Nope.
The Doctor Who. Now you sound like you're 80. I don't watch the Doctor Who. So
I tried watching one episode, but that was as far as I got.
Which episode was it?
The very first one.
That's always the next question. Yeah,
the first one of the reboot, anyway, or the new series.
Okay, the mannequins. Okay.
The one with the plastic monsters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a great place to start, sadly.
Weird, because it's episode one. You'd think it'd be the perfect place. Anyway, we're not going to get into that.
Yeah. go ahead. Listeners
Welcome
out there.
Welcome to Tardis Busters, your bi-weekly podcast about Doctor Who, the card game.
Actually, this structure of this game would work very well for a Doctor Who
card game. I was just but saying
anyway. Any of you all out there with free time on your hands, feel free to make that. I'll definitely play it. So beyond the quest itself, as it's kind of moving us into the second half of the campaign, it does mention there's, of course, new player cards that are going to focus on new ways to fight and investigate and new ways to interact with adventure. So the first one is a level 4 Rite of Seeking. So I think this is the first example we've seen of kind of the second tier of a leveled up card, if that makes sense. Because we got the other Rite of Seeking, and then, or am I just totally?
I don't.
Regular Rite of Seeking is level 0. No, it's level 0.
Oh, it is level 0. For some reason, I was thinking it cost XP. Okay, anyway, scratch that. So this is regular Rite for level 4 Rite of Seeking. Did you have this card up, Sean? Did you want to read it?
I do. Okay. I surely do. So level 4 Rite of Seeking costs 5 instead of your standard 4. It has 2 intellect pips, a spell trait, and uses 3 charges. Action, spend 1 charge, investigate. Investigate using willpower instead of intellect. You get +2 willpower for this test. If successful, you discover 2 additional clues at this location. If a skull, cultist, tablet, elder thing, or tentacle symbol is revealed during this test. After this test resolves, lose all remaining actions and immediately end your turn. And it takes up an arcane slot. So differences, differences here. You've got an extra cost, an extra pip, two extra willpower for the test, which is notable, and you get an additional clue. So assuming you're investigating at the standard one clue, you get three off of this successful test. So yeah, it's a really good card.
Yeah.
Four is a lot of experience.
I think this is worth it though.
Yeah, you know what's funny though is I think with that plus two willpower, this might be worth it in someone who's not Agnes, even more so because, oh, of course, never mind. That's silly. I was gonna say, what if Rex could take this? But that's not how leveling works.
Right. Nice try.
But I'm pretty sure. I mean, God, if you're investigating with Agnes at plus two willpower and you've likely already got a rosary down or something else, or you're level two Pete. Like you're not failing that test outside of the tentacle. Even if you lose the rest of your turn, that's three clues in one action. That's tempo.
Well, and even still, this just has the same drawback as original Rite of Seeking, which is all it means is play it as the last action of your turn, which that's such a situational drawback. Like most of the time, quote unquote, most of the time, you'll be able to manufacture your turn in order to do this on the last action of your turn. And now that you're getting plus two to will, you're going to be getting those three clues, barring some unforeseen consequence.
Yeah, I was going to say that maybe in solo it might be give me pause because there's not too many locations with three clues.
I was just
going to
say that.
But then
this
again,
is a multiplayer card.
You do get the plus two will, so potentially you're not having to spend a skill card or resources to pump. So maybe it's worth it in that respect.
I think if you're an investigator that you're playing and can take this, which I think right now is just Jim and Agnes, and I suppose Marie too. If they need a little bit of help investigating, this is not a bad way to spend the experience. But Jim takes it for sure.
Yeah,
and I think Agnes takes it. I don't know if Marie takes it though, because she's actually got pretty decent. She's at a four intellect, isn't she?
She is, yeah.
So I don't know. But anyway, it's good. It'll just be a matter of whether you ever take that four experience and look at this thing and go, yep, worth it. Or whether that four experience gets you those two luckies or the grotesque statue or two bind monsters. And that's more what you need.
Right.
I will echo what you were saying, Ian, that it's more valuable in multiplayer because you're going to have a better chance of hitting all three clues on this.
Yeah.
When there's more players in the game.
Definitely. Okay, so the other player card is I'm ridiculously excited about. This is a new green rogue card, a new skill card called Quick Thinking. It has the innate trait. If this skill test is successful by two or more, we see that theme once again. After it resolves, you may immediately take an action as if it were your turn. This action does not count toward the number of actions you can take each turn.
Wow.
So it's
a
two or
more. And it's a wild skill icon, so throw it down on anybody's test for anything.
Yeah. Okay, so just assuming my understanding of this is correct. Much like, is the you here the person who's performing the test or the person who throws the card?
Person who throws the card, wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
That's my assumption.
Yes. Yeah, I think they even give an example in the article, which I did not memorize, but I believe it shows that the person who's committing it is the one who takes the action because it's like an extra effect as opposed to something that's enhancing the actual, you know, whatever action is being taken. But anyway, there's just so many possibilities for this card because obviously if it's something on your turn, then you can, you know, get an extra action out of it. But then it also gets really interesting if you're like taking a, you know, skill test for a treachery that was drawn, something like that, or you know, committing it to another investigator's turn, and then all of a sudden you get to just do something completely out of turn.
Seems about right. I mean, God, what do you? I mean, it's just to say you're in the mythos phase, and God, I'm just trying to think of what do you plan to use this for, or is it something you plan? Maybe it's not something you plan. Maybe you just chuck it down and you go, all right, what's good right now? Resource card. Move.
Yeah, a free action is a free action. Use it for whatever you need to at the time. And save this card for a moment when you're like behind one. You know what I mean? Like, I love this. I love the theme of this card. The only thing that I'm not huge on is the successful by two or more. But as we've been seeing, that's actually not as impossible as we originally thought, or at least as I originally thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. Really, the sky is the limit with it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something as we all get our hands on this card and play with it, stuff will come up that we can't even think of right now, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, I have a feeling this could be the enabler for some weird ass combos in the future. if you can proc this at the right time and do something weird in a phase where you're not supposed to do it. I suppose there are a fair few cards out that say play only during your turn or something along those lines. So maybe they're watching for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a cool mechanic. I love the theme of it.
Yep, and it definitely plays into the whole rogues want more and more action. So definitely fits in that way. Go ahead.
I was going to say real quick, if you're looking at this article, they have like splash art behind the card itself in the article. And like, okay, the one for esoteric formula is just, you know, a book with symbols and everything, whatever. But this one is like this car with two guys in it and this giant hand just reaching in.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so cool. I'm going to post it in the chat here so that everybody can see it. But I love that. And I can't wait to see the card that art belongs to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't even register that was.
Neither did I.
I was just looking at the card.
Oh, those giant nails, and it's like this big four. Is there only four fingers? It looks like there's only, well, three and a thumb. And oh, you can even see the teeth and the face behind it just barely in the through the window. Oh, it's so sick. I love it.
Can you?
Yeah.
I think you're extrapolating.
You see teeth, right? And a little bit of an eye. If I had That's MS Paint open right now, I would circle those and post that in chat. But I don't, so I won't.
A Telecaster up in this bizetch.
John Madden for a minute.
Well, you see, when the enemy attacks you, you take damage. Okay, I see. Okay, I see it now. I was looking in the other window in the shit. We're talking about art on an audio. We're in an audio format. I think we need to redirect. Go look at that.
Well, I posted it in chat.
It's so in the article. It's really awesome.
Yeah. If you're listening to it later, stop what you're doing.
Just close your eyes on the freeway. Do theater of the mind. We will transport you to the back seat of this car.
So that was about it for the article. And those were the two cards. It looks like this player card set is going to focus on kind of the weird stuff. And the scenario itself sounds a bit weird. So look forward to that second quarter 2017.
I almost wish they didn't give us those like really, really wide release dates. That could be March. That could be June. That could basically be July at this point.
I definitely noticed they're being a little bit tighter on player card spoilers, at least compared to Lord of the Rings, I feel like. And I'm not mad. They tend to focus on like one or two key cards from each pack and highlight like in depth instead of like, boom, here's like five cards.
Right.
Yeah. I know it's not the popular thing, but I'm kind of weary of the spoiler culture that we live in where we need to just know everything and we need to know it now.
Mm-hmm.
I love going back to those days where the first time I see a card is when I crack it open in the pack. It's a fun surprise, and you're instantly like, oh my God, I now know about this card, and I can immediately put it into a deck instead of having to do the whole thing like, well, all right, I know it's coming. Do I proxy it? Do I not proxy it? Do I... Anyway, I digress. So that wraps us up for the news. Nick, I believe we had a dearth of guest articles in this past period. Is that correct?
Yes, and honestly, I haven't gotten the chance to check email the last couple of days, but from what I understand, we don't have any waiting in the wings currently. So if there's anybody who has an article floating around in their head that they just have to get out on paper about this game, please go to mythosbusterspodcast@wordpress.com. Was that right? Did I get that right? I'm not even looking. That's right.
It was close enough.
Right. mythosbusterspodcast.wordpress.com and write out an article for us. We would love to post it and feature it on our site. We've had a lot of great articles in the past. So, you know, the bar is high, but anything is at least a good submission idea. So, and if we go another week or so without any, I might write one or two. And rather than going to my own blog, I might throw one on there. So
the one thing we did have on our site is my little project of Spotify playlists for the Arc of Investigator. So this is a completely just for fun project that's not that serious, but I'm creating Spotify playlists of like modern music inspired by each of the investigators. I have Schizo Tool up there already, and Zoe will be out tomorrow. Well, if you're listening to this later on podcast, it will be out by the time you hear this.
And I'm currently working on Agnes. Nice. So far we have Black Magic Woman and Wrecking Ball. and we're open to suggestions from there. All right, awesome. Well, I think that moves us on to the meat of today's episode. Finally, guys, we get to spill the beans on the Night of the Zealot. I'm so excited to finally talk encounter cards. It's been so hard to restrain, like, oh, should we talk about this? Should we not talk about this? Well, we're talking about it tonight.
Yes. The leash is off.
Yes. So the Night of the Zealot. I mean, God, how do we start this? It's the one campaign that everyone who buys the game is for sure going to play, right? So let's start out, I guess, a little bit with the gathering. It's that first scenario that everyone plays. You know I still have a fondness, even though Passage Through Mirkwood, which is the first Lord of the Rings quest, similar to the gathering, even though that thing is so outdated and so simple, I still have fond memories for it. And I honestly think they did a better job with the gathering in this game than they did with Passage Through Mirkwood in Lord of the Rings in its kind of replayability. Mm-hmm. Did a good job of limiting the scope and teaching you how to play the game while still giving you an interesting scenario to play.
Definitely. I mean, just the whole idea of starting out in your house is like ingenious. Like, it's what I would imagine and kind of a video game approach. Like, if you take something like Fallout 3, where do you start? You start in essentially your home. And this is kind of a similar thing of like, you're going to start out in the place that's most familiar to your character and then just flip their whole world upside down. And the fact you start in one room, I feel like it just kind of unfolds the game to you in a way that makes sense.
You almost see like the screen prompts, like press A for jump.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the story goes, obviously there's been some grisly murders around Arkham, and the investigator that you're playing, or investigators if you have some friends, or are playing two-handed and don't have friends, but either way, you're cool, I promise. They're in their house investigating these murders. And I totally think it's awesome that that's where it starts. It's like, it's your house, you're there. It's like it's not the place where your investigators would expect something to go down, but all of a sudden, it goes down. And there's no way that can be coincidence, right?
That Lita
would, like, you think it's coincidence that, like, the one group of people who are actually paying attention in Arkham, that's the house where Lita happens to be throwing down her barrier?
Yeah.
Like, what are the odds?
I'm actually starting to think about this now.
She knows something.
Or did she intentionally lead the ghouls to your house to get you involved?
See?
The conspiracy unfolds.
Like, there's subtext here that's not apparent. Go ahead.
I had a thought, and now I want to make sure that I get it correct. There was a fan-made scenario that was a lead-up to Night of the Zealot. It was a solo scenario where you played as Lita Chandler. I don't remember the name of it, but it was posted on Board Game Geek. I'm gonna see if I can find a link to it real quick. You guys keep.
Oh, that's cool.
Talking while I do this. Talk, I say.
So anyway, as the story unfolds, doors start to appear, and apparently part of the house is crossed with some other part of Arkham or underground tunnels, or I don't know if it's technically like portals open or just like dimensions get crossed or whatever happened, but the house is no longer your own.
Yeah.
You discover these ghouls that are tearing up bodies and what have you, and Lita has set up a barrier to keep them out, a barrier of heat, since apparently these ghouls work for an entity of cold. Oh, yeah. I don't know. There's not a whole lot else to say that. You find Lita, hopefully, maybe, you convince her to join you. Ghoul Priest pops out, and hopefully you smack him upside his face.
Yeah, I kind of want to know more about the Ghoul Priest, like what his qualifications are, what rites he practices. You know,
does he have a license to be ministering in Arkham?
Where he's been ordained, if he went to the Ghoul Seminary, all those important questions. I think there's definitely a common thread in a lot of Lovecraft stories where people who tend to poke their nose into these things end up getting hunted by cultists and bad stuff happening to them. So I kind of assume that that's what's happening.
All right. So then that being said, what are some tips or tricks you might give to someone who's taking on the Gathering for the first time, or maybe someone who's taken on the Gathering a couple times, but may not have caught some of the intricacies?
It's kind of a tough one because it's fairly straightforward once you get the hang of it. So trying to think of what would
I've got one.
Okay.
Start
us off.
If you're in the Eller or the Eller, not the attic or the cellar, always be ready for those random spawns. Because even if you've got someone, your partner pulls that icy ghoul or the flesh eater, you could randomly get an unexpected enemy. So just always be aware and have a plan. I mean, you always want to have a plan no matter where you are in the game, but just be aware that there are some specific spawn enemies in the deck that can pop in at the attic and the cellar.
Yeah, speaking of spawning, since you start off in that one room, there's kind of a small trick, which is, like, say you get enough clues to advance, since you technically don't need to advance right away from that very first act, you can maybe wait till the next encounter guard draw, because if it's one of those big, ugly ones that spawn in specific places like the cellar or attic, since those locations aren't on the board yet, they just get discarded. Now, if you're specifically hunting them for their VP later, then maybe you don't want to do that. But if you're kind of in trouble and wanting to make sure that doesn't happen, that's an option.
I think another one that you want to just be ready for is Crypt Chill. So if anyone who's not Agnes, and even Agnes sometimes, depending on what difficulty you're playing on, you just always want to be ready for an asset to potentially go away. Or just be ready for a big asset or a big willpower test if that's something you want to keep. So it's nice to be able to keep an empty flashlight or maybe even a magnifying glass that you wouldn't mind losing as opposed to something else. But yeah, just being ready for that Crypt Chill, I think, is a good thing to do, both in this one and in the third scenario, I think, is where the other one... is this one in Midnight Masks?
No.
Look at the campaign guide.
I'm pretty sure it's in just The Gathering and The Devourer Below.
Yeah, 1 and 3.
Yep.
I believe that to be the case.
Yep, that is the case. The... Striking Fear encounter set.
That's the one.
Wait, is it? Yeah.
No, it's the.
No, it's not.
Striking
one...
Fear. It's the one that has Obscuring Fog in it as well.
Chilling
it's,
Cold.
It's the cold one. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. Chilling Cold. So the other thing, I don't know, and it's so hard to think about, you know, ridiculous, I guess, strategy for this one, because like Ian said, it is so straightforward, but I think this one does a good job of teaching you about positioning before advancing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there's the second act where you actually have to be in the hallway in order to break down the barrier. And the first time you're playing it, there's not a whole lot you can do to prepare because it's the first time you're playing it. Unless you're looking ahead, you know, you're just going to face check it. But if you're playing it with some strategy, you got to be ready for that ghoul priest. So everyone needs to be there and with their weapons out on their game. Hopefully you have a dodge tank to engage and subsequently evade the ghoul priest so that everyone else can gang pile on. Because retaliate hurts. So
it does.
That would be another
does.
Big one. So just be ready for the GP.
And I think because that first boss has retaliate, it does potentially teach players in multiplayer how to kind of work together to get around that. Like if one player is really good at dodging, they can engage that ghoul priest and evade them. And once that enemy is evaded, players can still attack that ghoul priest, but the retaliate won't trigger because it's evaded. And
right.
That is kind of a good way to avoid that if you have multiple players. Or even if you're by yourself, you can still do that.
Yeah, it's a good play. You just won't get as many swings at him. But the thing is the way that the ghoul priest hit points scale is it makes it just as good a play. So, all right. So I guess we're not going to get too in-depth into strategy on this one because it is so straightforward. But talking about resolving it. So this is, I think it's going to be that consummate first decision that an Arkham Horror player ever has to make. Burning the house to the ground. So what do you guys consider in whether or not you burn the house to the ground in any given campaign? And what do you guys think are the advantage, pros and cons of doing it one way or the other?
I mean, the main thing I consider is that that blue number with a brain behind it. How much sanity the lead investigator has, because if they choose to burn it down, they will get that mental trauma. For someone like Roland, that is tough to go from, you know, a really fragile 5 already to basically having 4 breathing room. And I guess the other big thing other than that to think about is whether you need Lita in your deck. Is she going to be doing work for you or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because Lita, of course, will help everyone with attack. And is it all investigators at your location get +1 attack?
At the location, yep.
Yeah. And
yeah, so that's as far as an ally goes, that's pretty baller right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it obviously she helps you with the enemies with the extra damage throughout the rest of the campaign.
Yeah.
But as a one of in your deck, she can, I don't know, she likes to hide sometimes.
Yeah. The other thing is her damage only amplifies for monsters specifically, which helps in scenario 3, which can be monster heavy, and not so much in scenario 2.
Except for the Night Gaunt enemies,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which granted is only 2 of them in the whole encounter deck, but still when they do show up.
Oh, they still friggin' show up all the time.
Yeah. About the whole, like, to throw in my thoughts with the burning the house down or not, like, another thing to consider, too, is the repercussions in Scenario 2, because this directly affects how you start. Without jumping the gun a little bit and talking about Midnight Masks before we're ready to, not having the house, like, it limits you with certain abilities. Like, the house has some pretty cool ability in the second scenario, but at the same time, by not having it there, you start already in the center of town, and that kind of saves you that movement action. So it's kind of 6 to 1, half dozen the other. And I think it depends on how many players you have and how much you can afford to lose that action to move to center of town, that sort of thing. But it's something to consider.
Yeah.
And it's kind of ridiculous how much that one action can count.
Yeah, totally.
I kind of wish that your house was considered to be and had the same travel locations as Riverside or downtown
Rivertown.
Or Southside. Rivertown, there we go. I wish it sat in one of the sections of town and it wasn't like you lived off in the boonies. It is what it is.
Afford that downtown rent.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if you're Wendy's lead investigator.
Gentrification is a thing.
Anyway. I feel like more often than not, I choose not to burn, so I guess I'm on team let it stand. team anti-Lita. There's definitely times when I have, because it just makes sense for that investigator.
Mm.
But I feel like, I don't know, I don't quite trust Lita.
Well, and let's also talk about the fact that you get an extra experience for letting your house stand.
Right.
The investigator gets that extra experience, which, you know, can count for something. I end up taking Lita more often than not, and taking the mental trauma.
Well, you do like playing with fire, so that makes sense.
This is true.
I also like having
the resolution option in the I like having that resolution option in the Devourer below, which we'll get to. It's not my first option. I don't like to get there.
Of course not.
I like to at least have the option to quell the ancient god.
She has eat me sign on her back.
Right, yeah. No, it's tempting to definitely take her for that, knowing that that is an option. But I've played Roland more often than not during this campaign, as is probably pretty obvious. So I almost always leave that house standing because it's like, okay, not only do I not suffer that trauma that is pretty crippling, but at the same time, I'm getting that extra experience, which means I can get shotgun plus a couple other things if I want to. And why would you not do shotgun? Actually, there are reasons to not do shotgun, and I'll go over them for Midnight Masks.
All right, fair enough. Well, that seems like a decent transition. So the Midnight Masks, whether or not you recruit Lita to go with you, I believe she informs you of the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Of these cultists that are hiding out in Arkham, and you need to root them out, find out what they know, and hopefully stop what they're trying to do. So to me, this is the first quest that really teaches you pace. The scenario, or the gathering
yes.
is a great little tutorial, teaches you the mechanics, but I don't think it pushes you terribly hard.
No.
And I don't think the scope of different outcomes is as wide as
right.
I've had playthroughs of Midnight Masks where I only get one or two cultists, and then I think I've never gotten all the cultists, though I've heard that is possible, but whatever, no video, no proof. But I have gotten five.
Mm-hmm. I think my highest is five as well.
I actually got six with solo Roland. He pulled it off.
Did you record it?
I did not know, so well, no one will ever believe me.
it's pretty hard to to verify that, then, isn't it? Ian?
And with Roland and Wendy, two-handed, but
See, two-handed, yeah. See, that's what I'm curious is, like, the amount of ground you have to cover in this one. I wonder if it's even possible to get all six in solo.
I mean, I think it is.
No, I think it is because, and that's this is kind of the follow up to what I was saying about upgrading a shotgun, which obviously. Anybody by now should know that shotgun is my favorite card in the core set, but because obviously it's a shotgun. But anyway, going from scenario one to scenario
two. Are you sure it's not the Tommy gun?
That might be. But no, going from scenario one to scenario two, starting out Midnight Masks, like, yeah, you usually get between what, like 5 and 9 experience, which is a pretty hefty amount, especially considering what we see from later scenarios, specifically ones that aren't in this campaign. But I think that going into Midnight Masks and knowing that, and obviously doing this the first time you're not going to know, but knowing what the map is like with Midnight Masks, getting 2 of police badge, I think is so much more worth your money as Roland, or worth your experience rather than doing the shotgun. Because shotgun's like, what, 4 experience, and you get it once, and maybe if you get an extra ammo, you're good to go. But those 2 police badges will allow you to cover more ground and get more clues and more cultists with a character that would struggle against some of those cultists, like the one that you have to dodge or, you know, those sort of characters. So I definitely think that I always go those police badges, and it's always worked out for me. Again, I haven't done all 6 like Ian apparently has. But I think But I think that did you upgrade to police badge with Roland then in your solo game, Ian?
I did not, no.
Oh, well then just go ahead and take a crap all over my whole argument right there. That's
no.
So that's, what did you all right, so what'd you upgrade then? That's interesting.
Because I will say that I think to pull it off, I think Roland is one of the best suited, but to pull it off, you definitely need some luck on my side. Like kind of one of the clinching moves was I can't remember the treachery. Is that on Wings of Darkness? Something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So that actually helped when I failed it, moving me to the center and allowing me to get that 6. Without that, I probably would have only gotten the 5, I think. So gotcha. You do need some things to go your way for sure.
That was actually going to be one of my weird strategy tips, is that sometimes you want Wings of Darkness to hit you, which is weird. I think a lot of people will just automatically try to throw stuff at that agility test to try to avoid it. But there are times where you're like, okay, you know what? I'll trade a damage to move three locations.
Sometimes it's worth it.
And disengage with these two enemies that I was unexpectedly fighting with.
The thing I really like...
Stand. Go ahead, Ian.
The thing I really like about this scenario is that I feel like this is one I'm going to go back to a lot, even in the future, because mm-hmm. it's such a puzzle of like, how many can I get? Yes. And it's kind of this personal challenge with each investigator. And although we're talking about kind of the magic number of six, the thing is about this scenario is that it's not necessary, number one. And number two, more than anything, if you're going into this scenario after you've played it one or two times, you just need to be clear for each investigator how many cultists you really need to get and which cultists. And that's going to be different for each investigator. Like, for example, with Windy solo, I don't need a ton. I need to kill the masked hunter because I don't want a hunter in the last scenario because I'm going to be getting away from all those enemies and I don't want any of them following me. As long as I get him and like two other ones and get three, that sets me up perfectly for scenario three. So you just need to have like kind of a good goal for each investigator, and it's different depending on what your strategy is going to be for scenario three.
Right. Yeah, because the thing is such a balancing act, because you're trying to get clues to get the investigators, but then there's also cultist enemies that are accumulating doom that are going to prevent you from getting those clues to get those cultists. And then you've got the Night Gaunts who are messing up your ability to move around properly, and they're really hard to evade depending on what difficulty you're playing on. And it really is just a puzzle. And to me, it is the one that feels the most like, this is Arkham Horror in a card game. This is what that is.
Yeah.
So I do believe this is our journey down the Anduin for you Lord of the Rings players out there. This is one that people are still... Yeah, it's going to be the ones that even in the future we're going to look back and go, like, that is just a good scenario.
Right.
Are there any locations that you, like, do you guys find yourself following a certain path through the map, or just does it kind of depend on?
The last few times I played as Roland, I think I've always done it, and it all depends on where enemies spawn and all that, but barring those conditions, it's usually... center and then go straight south and then just loop my way around. Yep, like
same here
clockwise. Okay. Yeah, so I don't know why I gravitate towards that path, but that's what's happened the last few times I've played. So
yeah, for me it's I'm hoping for that Maz boarding house so I can get the ally out, which is so key to a lot of decks.
If I'm playing Agnes or Daisy, I make a beeline for Miskatonic University.
Sure.
I'm trying to think. Other than that, I just try to assess the board itself. Also, I tend to try to get the graveyard out of the way early. It's so easy to just pop down there. I mean, assuming you can make that willpower test as opposed to taking the horror.
Right.
It's so easy to just pop down there and with a shroud of one, just suck up those clues and then get your first cultist out, since you're connected straight there from the from Rivertown.
Right.
Especially with Agnes. With anyone else, it may not be such a big thing, but Agnes, like naked Agnes, could go straight into the graveyard and be like, yeah, I don't care about a willpower test of three, go for it.
So that's a really naked weird Agnes sentence. Does on our weekends.
I was about to say, that is a really weird sentence outside of this specific context.
I think I avoid the graveyard until, I think it's Peter Warren, is that the cultist that spawns at the graveyard? Like, once he shows up, I'm like, well, it's like, damn it, I have to go there now. But otherwise, I'm like, nope, I don't know. That's on the exact opposite side of this town that I'm at right now, so I'm not even going to worry about it. Although the last time that I played, I think I ended the game with a mob that was just following me location by location, where it was the Masked Hunter and two Night Gaunts just one location behind me the entire time. And it was like, just got to keep moving. Just can't stop. Just got to go. Oh, it was
we
scary.
We can see you.
Yeah.
Those Night Gaunts drive me crazy. Like, there was one game, I think I was playing Daisy or something like that, but they there were like two Nightgaunts tailing me for a long time, and there was a choice to actually go for like one more cultist versus no, it couldn't have been Daisy because I had dynamite. It was someone who had dynamite, but it was a choice between getting one last cultist or dynamiting the Nightgaunts, and I chose blowing up the Nightgaunts.
I don't think anyone can blame you.
Yeah, I wasn't going to let them live after that annoyance.
The salt is real with the Nightgaunts. God, those things are annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't...
So, go on.
The cool thing is I don't think there is necessarily one right way through the map, and that's the replayability. Sometimes I feel like I'm kind of stuck in my comfort zone of my path, so maybe I need to try different ways.
And I want to talk for a quick second about the brilliance of Agenda 1.
Mm.
Do you guys remember that moment where Agenda 1 advanced? And you're like, oh, what happens to me? Oh, God, it's a monster.
How is that possible?
What? What do I do with it?
Is this a misprint?
I guess I drew it. Yep.
Yeah, so really that's that moment. You're like, well, all right, well, it's in my hand, and I just, okay, I guess I just drew this.
Yeah.
Go on.
That does so much to set the tone of the rest of the whole life of the LCG.
Mm-hmm. Where just like you can't trust any cards in any pile ever. Sometimes they're just going to just get you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I thought that was brilliant where all of a sudden they even warn you at the beginning of the quest, like, hey, not all the cultists will be in the cultist deck.
Wink.
And I also think the Masked Hunter is interesting how they scale him. Instead of just a straight multiplier, his multiplier is lower than his base health.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of being a 5 that gets +5 for each other investigator, he's a 4 that gets +2 for each other investigator.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a cool way to, I guess, if he was like the Ghoul Priest where he was just a straight scale, that would be ridiculous in this high-paced quest where you've...
Right.
Really got to move, and you've really got every action absolutely has to count.
The other thing about this scenario that it teaches you that the first scenario doesn't, this is kind of the next step of your tutorial, which is how this campaign game works. And sometimes resigning is good. Sometimes your goal is to do some things and resign when you can instead of, I mean, because that's such a twist from like most other card games and board games that I can think of where, you know, that's quitting is generally a bad thing. So this one, I think, does a great job of teaching you that, oh, yeah, you know, it's definitely giving you the hints that if it hits midnight, that's a bad thing. So you should probably get out before then.
Yes, that's what's really cool. There's nothing in the game mechanically that tells you you should be resigning. But if you're looking at the story and you're realizing what happens and you're on agenda 2 and you're like, oh, this is the clock striking midnight,
mm-hmm.
then hopefully you can put 2 and 2 together and resign before midnight. Because if you don't, it's real rough. I don't like what happens if you don't.
I was just going to say, has anyone else ever let it get to midnight? Because I did for one game and I will never let that happen again.
Yep, same. I wanted to see what happened. And I regret that decision.
I honestly think that my thought immediately before I set up scenario 3 was literally, how bad can it be? It's just midnight. Well, it turns out it can be pretty bad.
You're going to turn back into a pumpkin. I mean, I guess as far as strategy tips go, we've been talking about them, but manage the board, get those clues. I think one of the biggest things is you want to try to, at least the way I play it, is I try to burst, acquire, and then immediately spend clues if I can so that the game doesn't have an opportunity to take them away from me. So if I can get into a situation, get them out on the table as quickly as you can. If you can spare an action, or if you can spend an action, don't even think about whether you can spare it unless you're engaged with an enemy who's about to kill you. But if you can spend that action to get a cultist out, do it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously be prepared for the Masked Hunter to come out. So when it's getting close to that, you want to think about being set up. Where are you going to choose to fight that battle and make sure you have the cards in hand that you need to do it?
And a couple other things about the Masked Hunter, since he is kind of the boss of this scenario. doesn't have retaliate, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
He's got remarkably low agility. Mm-hmm. So evading him, especially in multiplayer, is easy, and I think a pretty decent call, assuming your team is nearby you and can come capitalize on the fact that you just nerfed the boss enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think the whole, you know, dodge tank and then spank him into oblivion is even better for the Masked Hunter than it is for the Ghoul Priest.
Yeah, the Masked Hunter is definitely the slasher in the slasher flick that is the Midnight Masks. Like, he's the slow guy that walks behind you that's easy to avoid but hard to deal with head on. So yeah, evading him would definitely be the number one way to go if possible. And it's even possible to do as Roland in certain situations. Like, I've evaded him successfully a couple times as Roland, as long as you have, you know, a manual dexterity or something to ditch to give you that little bit of a boost. But yeah, if you have a character that can do it outright, like Wendy or Skids, even better. Mm-hmm.
That's why I know sometimes it might seem a tall task for Wendy solo, but she can easily evade him, and then that your friends mm-hmm. backstab and sneak attack are what's going to allow mm-hmm. you to finish him off. And for the other cultists, it's important to keep in mind, and sometimes easy to forget, you don't have to use their parlay actions to get rid of them. You can just kill them if it's easier for your particular investigator.
Which for Roland, it usually is easier just to blow them away.
Yep. It's like, I don't want to dodge you, shotgun.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, one interesting thing that I was just paging through the locations here, and it sprung to mind. Northside is the mm-hmm. location where you can spend an action and 5 resources to get 2 clues from the token pool.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you guys actually do that? Like, I feel like I'm always trying for it, but I almost never actually pull the trigger on that, because either a cultist needs addressing, or, oh, one of the cultists shows up, you know, one of the named cultists shows up somewhere else and I have to divert. I think maybe only one time have I ever actually gotten there, had the resources to spend, and the action to trigger that.
Yeah, same here. Once, I think, was the only time that I actually took advantage of it.
So. I've definitely done it a few times, and there's been a lot more time trying for it and ending up not falling short. And there's also been times when I've spent that 5 and then it came back to bite me because I needed those cards to deal with, I mean, those resources to deal with stuff later on and play sure. cards. But mm-hmm. it's definitely something you can pull off with the right investigator, but can also be a bit of a trap if you're not careful.
Yeah, right? That's the why I asked. Is to me, that seems like a bit of a trap, just based on my plays. Is like, unless you've got a very specific situation where you can get there, spend it, and then get the cultist on the table, I might think twice before trying to trigger that action. Just get there, get the clues, get your VP.
Yeah, it seems like a good a good Skids or maybe Wendy action, simply because movement and resources are generally not as hard to come by for someone like Skids.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as Roland, it's a bit tougher. And as someone like Daisy, maybe even, who's like, well, I'm just going to investigate and then get on out of here, you know. But someone like Skids, you can usually pop in there via a card effect, and then you probably have extra resources, you know, depending on how your game's going. So it seems like more of a Skids, maybe Wendy sort of action.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The other cultist who can be a bit of a trap is the one at the university. I don't have the cards in front of me, so Sean.
Peter Warren.
Oh, that's Peter Warren. Okay, so Peter Warren, he can also be a bit of a trap because I believe it's spending 2 clues to do the parlay. And sometimes that's worth it, but you also are keeping in mind that those are clues you could be using to reveal another cultist potentially. So don't just automatically go for that one. You have to kind of assess how much that's gonna hit your pace and whether there's you can just kill him outright. He's not too tough. So
yeah, that's the other thing, is like, as an enemy, he's super easy to kill. So just smack him in the face, I feel. So while we're talking about the specific named cultists, another one I would like to point out is Ruth Turner, who's the mortician. And she's the one with 5 evade, and after she's evaded, she goes to the victory display. So if you're playing an investigator who can pack it, pack a stray cat. Because that is awesome. Just, nope, stray cat gone. Cultists, set it and forget it. It's in the victory display, you don't have to worry about it. Now, as far as the other ones go, they're all pretty straightforward. Wolfman Drew, you legit just have to fight him.
Yep.
Peter, we've discussed, is a little bit of a trap because clues are kind of harder to come by. And yeah, I don't know, I guess unless you're in a really good position, probably easier to just kill Peter Warren. Victoria, I'm kind of in about the same boat as Peter Warren. Like, you could spend the 5 resources, but she's only a 3 fight and 3 health. Like, I don't know. Just beat her up.
Yeah, if you have the resources, then you spend them. If not, depends.
And then I feel like Herman, I go back and forth on because he's got 4 health, so he takes a little bit to kill. But more often than not, I end up discarding the cards for him because, I don't know, seems like, hey, just to, I don't know, probably empties half my hand, but just to get another damn cultist in the victory display, it seems kind of worth it most of the time.
Yeah.
Even though I think 4 cards and 5 resources are probably about equivalent as far as like game pace cost. So I don't know why I feel one way on one and one way on the other.
I feel like sometimes that's why once he pops up, I kind of leave him towards the end, like one of the last things I'm going to do, because then I can just ditch those cards and they won't hurt me by their absence later on.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. So as far then as resolutions go, I'm trying to look through the other cards in the set here. I don't think there's anything really to talk about. We've talked about On Wings of Darkness. It's weird. Sometimes you want that to hit. Because getting back to Rivertown is... Because that's the only central location in the whole thing, right? That's kind of the...
Mm-hmm.
The thing. Interesting how they did that, though, where Wings of Darkness moves you to a central location. And what that does is it lets them recycle this Night Gaunt encounter set into later quests or into later scenarios, because then they can just denote in which, you know, each separate scenario, which one is the central location. And then that's where the Night Gaunts drag you.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone was wondering kind of like why it didn't just say move you back to Rivertown,
sneaky,
I suspect
sneaky.
That's why. We'll probably see that one again. I think another big trick is if you've got an investigator who can just kind of willy-nilly deal out damage, you know, like Agnes or possibly even a Roland with a guard dog or a Skibs with a guard dog or something like that. They're great to root out those acolyte cultists, especially when you get the mysterious chanting when the acolyte has like 3 damage on it. You absolutely need to go kill that thing. It's nice to be able to just pop into the location and then just have done with it.
Yeah.
But that's no mystery. Random damage is just always a good thing, I think, in any scenario. So then, moving on. Well, I suppose as far as resolutions go for the Midnight Masks, I think my most... I'm generally at 3 to 4 cultists. What are you guys generally sitting at when you complete that one?
Average, yeah. 3 to 4 is about average, I would say, depending on investigator. Roland tends to be a little higher for me. Because of his action compression.
Yeah. Going after a cultist with Roland, there's just all the more incentive, isn't there?
And also number of players. Solo, you are hard-pressed compared to... Because I've tried it two-handed, and solo definitely tend to do much better two-handed.
Yeah, I'm interested to see where that sweet spot is, because the more players you have, the more clues are required of you to trigger the things, but also the more ground you can cover. So I almost feel like maybe two-handed is the sweet spot, or two-player is the sweet spot. But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe just covering more ground, and as long as everyone's got a well-rounded deck and they can kind of just deal with whatever comes their way, maybe that is the better way to play.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have enough 4-player games under my belt to...
Yeah, definitely not. Well,
only a few.
I think the other thing worth mentioning is just that if you do get the all 6, you get the special resolution, which gives you a bit more backstory about each of the cultists, which you do not get any other way.
Well, damn. I've never gotten that. I did not know that. I will be reading that tonight. Now I kind of don't care. Although with Duke at my disposal, I feel like this scenario just got easier.
Yeah, I think Ashcan could do some serious work for sure.
Duke is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ashcan's just along for the ride, but All right, so I think that wraps us up for Midnight Masks. Let's move on to that that culmination, that terrible, terrible coming together of all the story threads, the Devourer below.
Big U.
Yes. So I think one of the first things to note is that in the setup for this quest, a couple big things to note. First is you add an Elder Thing token to the Chaos Bag. Just straight up, doesn't matter what you did before, you add an Elder Thing token to the Chaos Bag, and it is not good. It is not a thing you want to see. On easy and standard, that sucker's a -5. On hard and expert, that sucker's a -7. That thing's rough. So I think it tends not to play a huge part because it is only like, what, 1 in 17 tokens or something around those lines, right, depending on what difficulty you're playing on. But when it shows up, it makes an impact.
Mm-hmm. It surely does.
And then I think the other thing to mention is that in the setup for this one, which I think is really interesting and adds a lot of replay to this one, is that you add a random Agents of X set to the encounter deck. So it's either Yog-Sothoth, Shub-Niggurath, Cthulhu, or Hastur.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys' least favorite one?
That's I think mine's Hastur.
The only ones that I've actually seen hit table were Shub-Niggurath and Hastur. I think I had Yog-Sothoth in the encounter deck once, but I lost before any of his cards ever hit play, and I don't think I've ever had Cthulhu in the deck, so
I don't think I've ever played against Yog. I don't think that's ever actually come
other
up.
Than in Dunwich.
No, sorry, I mean Shub-Niggurath. I've played against
oh, okay.
Yog-Sothoth.
Yeah.
Cthulhu's bad. I don't particularly like it. But since I tend to play Agnes, I think she has a less hard time with it than other investigators would.
Sure.
Definitely Hastur is the one that has screwed me over the most times. And there was a streak of like the first five games where that one was chosen randomly every single time. So I grew to really hate it. But I also have kind of a love-hate relationship because he's like my favorite.
Yeah.
Of the old ones from like the Arkham Horror, Arkham Files world. The one that can be, so that's probably, yeah, my least / most favorite. The Shub can definitely be tough if you are a investigator who wants to not fight like Windy, Daisy, people like that. That one tends to hurt quite a bit. Because all the monsters.
Yeah. Yeah,
my Shub Shake brings all the monsters to the yard. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Sorry, I must have my Yog mixed up in my Dunwich stuff right now. I don't remember exactly what's in that one.
The door and the key. It has the Yithian observers who discard cards from your hand.
Yithians.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those are not fun.
Right.
God, yeah, those are not fun.
Yithian.
There's no good solution here. Oh yeah, and Offer of Power, that's the other one. Oh man, Offer of Power.
I love that card though, especially multiplayer for the peril aspect.
That is a rough card, man. I mean, two Doom is a lot. I mean, you get two cards, which is cool. And two Horror, depending on your investigator, is a lot for a single card. I mean, yeah. There are investigators where there is no choice, and you put the Doom on there. So, yeah, Yog might be up there. It's either Yog or Hastur for me. But anyway, moving on to the scenario itself. Moving into the Arkham Woods, which I thought was a pretty cool mechanic, where all the locations aside from the path that you start on are the kind of unknowns until you flip them over and you go there, which is a mechanic that I have a fair suspicion that we'll see repeated going forward, which we already have in Dunwich in a couple ways. So the other thing that I really liked about this is that the locations that you get, a lot of them have skill replacement tests where you investigate using blank instead of intellect. I actually think it swaps because there's one for willpower, there's one for combat, and there's one for agility.
Yeah.
So depending on what investigator you're playing with, that can be cool. And you can also, I don't know, I just always seem to get the wrong one. Like, I never get the willpower one when I'm playing Agnes.
That's how it goes. Never, like, ever. You'll be playing multiplayer, and, like, Wendy will go into the tangled thicket or whatever it is, and it's like, okay, Roland needs to get over there, and then Roland's turn, they move into a different one, hoping it might be something similar, and it's, like, the one that uses, you know, agility, and it's like, well, what the heck? Like, this is just bananas. So it's you definitely want to be aware of those going into the scenario. I remember our first game, it was just like, oh, well, if that one's combat, I got to get over there. And then we're like trying to spending actions, moving in and around each other and exchanging locations and stuff like that.
Yeah, pardon me. Excuse me.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it felt like. And what's interesting about the way that the clues scale and what you need to advance that first act is you almost need to get all of the clues, depending on the, of course, the mix up that you get, because you only get 4 out of the 6, right? Of the possible Arkham Woods.
Right.
And some of them don't actually spawn clues.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of them doesn't spawn clues. So if you get the Arkham Woods, which allows you to heal damage or horror, then you could be in a situation where, you just need all the clues that are out on the board.
Yeah, right. That's why I actually hate getting that one, because I'm like, it's slowing me down. I just want to.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I almost feel like, yeah, it's cool that we can sit for a minute and heal some damage and horror, but I don't want to sit for a minute and heal some damage or horror. I got to get moving. So even though it seems like a boon, it is actually, I don't like seeing that one show up, oddly enough.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of multiplayer experience. Obviously, I play solo the most, but I do have two-handed experience, and maybe it was the particular investigators I was playing, which was Skids and Daisy, but I found it useful to have one investigator. Obviously, Daisy's kind of going to be the powerhouse investigator. So using one investigator, Skids, to be the scout, and kind of, because since he's so mobile, and try to just move and see what the locations are so that Daisy doesn't waste any of her time going to the wrong location. And Encyclopedia was so huge in that scenario.
And now Ashcan will fulfill that. I'm sorry, Duke will fulfill that role.
Yep, he's a good scout as well. Makes sense.
Because he can sneak in, and even if you randomly wander into the one with, I think the only one he doesn't like is the one that makes you test for combat. Because if you wander into the one that uses intellect, great, Duke's at a 4. If you wander into the one that uses willpower, great, Ashcan's at a 4. If you wander into the one that uses agility, then great, Ashcan's a 3, which is, you know, passable. God, Ashcan's so good.
Yeah, he definitely seems like the solo investigator right now. So
he's so good. Okay, so then obviously I think this one is hard to talk about in a vacuum because, of course, this is one of our first big examples of how this campaign is going to work. Your success, or at least the setup for your success in this scenario, is largely informed by how well you did in the prior scenario. If you let it go past midnight, you might end up with a couple fewer cards in your hand at the beginning of the scenario, which it hurts, especially when you're looking to get set up to go forth. And then as well, when agenda 2? I don't know, which one brings out all the... There we go. It's agenda, or it's Act 1B. Act 1B brings out all the cultists who got away. So depending on how many you got in the Midnight Masks, that could be just a proper party on the main path in Devourer Below.
So that's one of the core parts of your strategy going in then, is you need some way of dealing with that party in the center, unless you got the 6 cultists, and then it doesn't matter, or even 5, because then you're just dealing with one. But otherwise, you need some kind of strategy. So that might be my friend the cat burglar, that might be dynamite, that might be cunning distraction, but some kind of way. You obviously most of the time don't want to just go in there and take on like 3 or 4 guys at once.
Right.
So hang on though, does everyone have a good solution for it? So hang on, so we've got dynamite and guardians. We've got evasion in rogues, or cat burglar if you prefer. The rogue has two good solutions. We've got cunning distraction in survivor. Mm-hmm. So I think that just leaves Seeker and Mystic that don't have like a, oh, this just fixes that problem.
They don't have a mass deal with the issue. So Daisy is really kind of, Daisy's totally up a creek when it comes to dealing with more than one enemy.
Yeah.
And Agnes at least can pull Cunning Distraction, you know. So
yes.
One thing that I wanted to point out about the letting it get to midnight and midnight masks and how that affects this scenario. It's like, it's not, you don't just start with a reduced hand size. You pull your regular hand and then you discard random cards from it. So in a way that's worse because those cards are then removed unless you're Wendy, but then they're removed from your pool. And unless they're, you know, two copies of, then you're probably not going to see those again. So, and if one of those is dynamite and you're like me and you run one dynamite, well, get ready to run as Roland. So,
I guess obviously a multiplayer that more options because someone can, one investigator can kind of run interference while the others to try to start dealing with the ritual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first time we ever played it, that's what happened. Is I think Nick was you who went in first, and I came in after you, so that Daisy could scoot in behind us and get to the ritual site.
Yes, and, Roland and Agnes. Roland moved in, engaged everybody. Agnes moved in and helped kind of mitigate it, but we didn't get everybody taken care of. And if I remember right, Daisy and Skids moved through to the ritual site, and then they got taken care of. Quote unquote. And then Agnes and Roland were like, well, we're going to resign.
So then speaking of the ritual site and Amordhoth, so the ritual site is pretty cool. I like that mechanic that it keeps regenerating clues. So you can just kind of sit there and you're dealing obviously with what the agenda, or sorry, it's the act that wants you to get the clues is telling you to do. And it keeps regenerating clues, but everyone else kind of has to be running interference for you.
Yeah.
And then Amordhoth.
The cool part of the ritual site is that you have to spend the clue and it's gone to do that test. I believe it's agility or combat, I want to say.
No, it's agility or will.
Agility or will, that's right. You can tell I'm usually using agility based on the people I play. But because if it was just straight gathering clues to end the campaign and scenario, it's not quite as dramatic. But I find that whole thing of like spend a clue and if you mess up, it's gone and you have to kind of start over again.
It is a burnt cost.
It makes it a sunk cost. So tense with that time ticking down. So that design is right on the money for me.
Well, it feels so thematically perfect because these cultists are trying to summon forth this old god and you're trying to disrupt the ritual. And of course, everyone's seen whatever movie it is where they've got a similar situation. And you know that if you don't act quickly enough and intelligently enough, it's just gonna happen. So having that ticking clock behind you in the form of the agendas, it feels so exactly like what it's going for.
Yeah, and it's so much better than just putting like a high clue wall. Like they could have just said spend, you know, 20 clues and finish the scenario. But this feels, not only does it doesn't feel as cheap as if they were to do something like that. So this really is a good way to end this first campaign.
Yeah, there's like two layers to it.
Mm-hmm.
So then Amordhoth, the big U, big bad, everything that we've been fighting against. So it's interesting to see our first little brush with an ancient one. So I think he looks like a big icy tornado. I will reaffirm that from our developer interview. Nate French has an admitted phobia of tornadoes, which you'll hear about, or you have heard about, because we'll probably release that one first, because time is weird.
Yeah. All but relative.
3 damage, 3 horror. He's a 5/6 plus 6, and readies at the end of each investigator's turn. So holy cow, what a boss. Like, I know there's that thing out there where like, hey, if it has stats, we can kill it, and that's just kind of the power gamer's mindset, but this guy's the thing. He's got 10 health at the minimum. So Ian, I believe you have killed the big U, is that correct?
I have, yeah. With Agnes and who was the other one? It must have been Skids, actually. Which kind of brings up one of the big things I wanted to talk about is there are kind of, there's the strategy that just goes with where I think the scenario is leading you, which is trying to get to the ritual site. And if you mess up and Big U comes out, then you have to fight him. But there's also mm-hmm. the alternative strategy is you just forget getting clues, game loading up, which is kind of what I did in those successful ones. And I don't know, I've kind of expressed this on the Discord before that I find that one not as satisfying because if you spend that many rounds loading up, you can kill pretty much a lot of things, I think. I would be more impressed with myself if I did it, you know, on the fly as Big U came out unexpectedly. But like with Agnes, it was something ridiculous, like 2 forbidden knowledges, 2 shrivelings. What else did I have? Basically the full Agnes kit. Lucky's in hand, all kinds of stuff. It's like, yeah. But it pretty much took it out in a couple turns. But I don't know. What do you guys think about that? Is it like, does it feel cheap to you? Have you even tried that method?
I honestly never have gotten to that point because usually we're either in a good enough place that we've shut down the ritual and he just never comes out, or we're so far behind the ball that he comes out and just murders everyone. I've never kind of been in the middle area where, I don't know, I guess I plan for it. Nick, have you ever hit him?
I've never killed him. The 2 times that he's actually hit table for me, one was during our 4-player game, the very first time we played it. So, of course, we were doing it how you would expect to run a scenario, which is gather the clues, do what the act says, you know, rather than wait it out. And the other one was when me and my wife made it to scenario 3, which, you know, exact same thing, play the game how it is supposed to be. Every other time I've gotten to scenario 3 doing a true solo game and usually doing it on hard, I'm out of the game before I even get to the ritual site. Like, I can't even get to it. So I usually have 1 or 2 mental trauma by that point. I usually have, you know, my weakness and it's just rolling solo on hard. Like, it's either all in my favor or everything's against me is what I'm learning. So often it's the latter.
So One thing I want to throw this out at you guys. I don't know if you saw this on the old forums, but there was one dude who posted who had claimed to have broken the game or have, you know, figured out how to beat the game easily. So apparently what you do is you make sure you burn down your house in scenario 1 so that you have Lita. And then in scenario 3, you sit on the main path drawing cards until you find Lita. And then let the agenda advance because it's the act that brings out the cultists, not the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you let the agenda advance, you're sitting there, you've got Lita down, the act advances, and Mordhoth comes out, and then you can immediately just chuck Lita to a Mordhoth and end the game.
Hmm.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I guess it depends on what you define as winning. Because if you're going to take this in the sense of like most other games out there, then yeah, technically that's a win and that's a very kind of easy and I would venture cheap way to do it. But I mean, as far as story is concerned and the narrative is so tightly wrapped in this game with the actual mechanics and how it plays and what we're doing, like, I don't think that's meant to be a win. That's meant to be like, we survived by selfishly sacrificing someone to a god, and we're not mad about that. I don't know. I don't know if that counts as breaking the game when you're getting a resolution that I think is supposed to be like dark and mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Casey brings up a good point, which is something that we forgot to mention with the gathering. Casey in chat says that if everyone dies in scenario 1, you get Lita anyway. So why even bother? Like, why do anything? Just let the agenda run out every time.
Just die in scenario 1, resign immediately in scenario 2, and then sit on the... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What an easy game.
That's kind of where I'm at when people do this. Because people do this in Lord of the Rings all the time. In fact, I podcast with someone who's very, very good at doing this. Just kind of breaking things down mechanically. And finding loops or you know, whatever you want to call this, kind of cheesing their way through what is the obvious intent of how these things are supposed to work.
Right.
And
it is a cheese.
I'm always yeah, I'm always just kind of like, well, okay, all right, whatever. I'm not going to play with you if you're doing that, but if it floats your boat, go for it.
You know what, though? The newbie StarCraft player in me loves cheese strategies every so often, though. Like when I was playing StarCraft pretty heavily, if I'd lose a couple games, like, legitly, I would just cheese the next game because, like, he's not going to expect a barracks right outside his opening base, you know, something like that. So every so often, if I'm salty enough, I'll go for that cheese strategy just to hopefully get out a win.
Salty and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that it kind of brings up another discussion, which could be a whole podcast topic in itself, which I'm curious to talk with you guys about at some point, which is how much you let kind of the RPG aspect and what would your character do influence how you approach scenarios. Because like in the Agnes case, where the reason why I ended up just kind of preparing for Big U and not even trying to go to the ritual site, which similar to kind of this lead to solution feels a bit weird for me from a narrative perspective, but it's because I only got two cultists the previous scenario. So I'm like, well, I have not a chance in hell. I might as well just prepare for it, which I could actually justify in my head in the story. Like Agnes knows it's too late and she's just going to get ready and like meditate and get ready for whatever's coming out. Like, they can probably justify that story-wise, but it's harder for me to justify, like, we have this lady with us and we're just going to be, like, playing Yahtzee in the middle of this clearing waiting for this god to come out so we can push her into it and go back home.
I think in my solo games, I'm much more likely to do it. And not the first time I play solo, because while it is, quote-unquote, a win, it doesn't feel like, it's not a win in the way that the designers intended, I don't think. I obviously can't guess what they intended us, how they intended us to play the game. But based on the way that it's designed, it doesn't feel like that's what they wanted us to do, was just to sit through everything, let everything advance, and then just cheese our way to victory in the last second. So I think solo game, to really test my mettle, I'll play it, you know, straight up, do everything as intended the first few times. But then there may be a game where I'm like, I want to run, you know, expert difficulty with Roland solo through Night of the Zealot and see if this works, see if I can do it. And you know sure. I won't say that I'm above not doing it, because I'm not. I will do it at some point. but I will prefer the other method for sure.
Well, I think there's something very telling about the way that they made the language in this game works as far as the narrative piece. They never use the word victory. They never use the word defeat. It is always resolution.
Right.
At least as far as the investigators and the story resolution goes, obviously you can defeat enemies and investigators themselves can be defeated, but
well, except for when you read the resolutions of the Devourer below, not to burst your bubble, Sean, but if all investigators were resigned or defeated, the last bullet point there is the investigators lose. If resolution one or two,
it's the culmination.
Right, well then resolutions 1 and 2 specifically say the investigators win. So, sure. I mean, if you want to argue semantics, which I really don't, but...
Well, you just did, asshole.
I'm not arguing, I'm just pointing out verbiage. Anyway, no, like I said, they intend us to play a certain way. The game is built around you trying to stop this thing from happening rather than just sitting on your trump card and, you know, playing at the last second. And ultimately, what's more fun? Yeah, what's more fun, you know? Is it more fun to go through the actions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think they're the kind of people who like to look at these puzzles and very mechanically. They're not doing it in a legit way, like, oh, every time I play this, I'm going to do it. They've solved the puzzle, the mechanical puzzle in their mind, and that's kind of where it ends. At least the ones that I've played with, you know, Chris Seastan and in my other podcast is that way, where he plays some really, really weird decks. But if he ever came and sat down at a table next to people, he would never bring any of those. So I guess it's all in how you make it.
Right.
I mean, I think of it similar in terms of like a tabletop or even video game RPG, where obviously there's something that's quote unquote a win because you beat the bad guy and you're alive. But there's definitely different grades of that, whether someone died, whether the world is better off or whether you cause some big problem in it, you know, all those aspects. And so I think having that kind of clear you're defeated or you win text is a concession to gamers who need that. But I think going forward, we do have to like think, kind of adjust our thinking a little bit in the way we kind of think about these resolutions, that it's not going to be clear cut maybe until the very end.
Yeah, no, definitely. That fits theme of this campaign, or the theme of this game, rather. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. To keep it gray.
Even in the successful one, don't you gain something like 3 trauma, mental trauma, and 3? I can't remember the exact numbers.
That's just what I was reading through the resolutions right here, and I'm like, God, even when you like quote unquote win and you defeat or you beat Immortoth back into the dimension from which it emerged, you get 2 physical trauma and 2 mental trauma.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
But you get victory X plus 10.
Ooh.
Which to me is so interesting, because it's like, here's all this experience that we are encouraging you not to use.
I do want to try it at some point, do the continued campaign and see how it works.
Right.
Pure chaos.
I really should do that. I have a couple campaigns that I brought through to the end that I could probably pick up and see how it works. But yeah,
one of the notable aspects of the scenario I think we didn't touch on, because it's notable to me because it's the one that has most often resulted in me cussing and wanting to break furniture, which is, I believe it's the 2B agenda, I want to say, the one that makes you do the willpower 6 test or you gain a new weakness. That one has screwed me over so many times. You know, the classic, paranoia when I was sitting on 10 resources, or amnesia when I had my handful of cards with Windy ready to just demolish the ritual site. Like, that one has just messed me up so many times. So do you guys find yourself preparing for that test, or is it just kind of, if I pass it, I pass it?
I mean, how do you prepare for it? I mean, if you're anyone but Agnes, you're probably gonna fail it. Like, I know people can get lucky, and you know, I suppose you can have one of the mercenary skill tests out there where you can pump and sit on some resources and pay and make sure you succeed it, but I don't know. I think with everyone that I've played through that but Agnes, I've failed it.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I think that's true. It might only have been one time where I actually passed that stupid thing. It's more just crossing your fingers and hoping you don't draw the one weakness that is going to destroy you.
Right. I don't think I've ever planned for any weaknesses in any of my decks ever. Like, I throw them in and I'm like, okay, we're playing the game. Draw a card. Damn it! And then it's like, how do I deal with this now? I don't ever plan ahead when it comes to that. I'm always like, how do I deal with what's in front of me at this moment?
Yeah, I think depending on your investigator, that may matter more in some situations than other. Like,
right.
You never draw last action with Agnes. I'm trying to think who else that would apply to. I guess it was like Roland and not Wendy. You probably don't want to draw last action with Wendy either. That's awful. But anyway.
Yeah.
So that's the Night of the Zealot. So our first campaign in its completion. I feel like, at least as far as what I've experienced in Dunwich, it is a little bit more compressed, where I don't think we can expect to get just the bonus 2 experience, like the participation award at the beginning of the first scenario for campaigns going forward, just for completing it. At least, spoiler alert, you don't get that in Dunwich. You have to earn your experience the hard way. You have to trudge 15 miles in the snow just to...
Yeah, I guess as far as like overall thoughts on the campaign, because it is so compressed, I think it feels a bit more puzzly, and not in a bad way, because I really like this core campaign as just kind of a tight story and mechanics. Like, I think it's probably one of the best core products for any LCG.
Agree.
But not that I'm biased or anything, but... But I guess after you've played it a bit and you're really trying to maximize things you can, because 2 so directly leads into 3 and kind of determines everything, that you can kind of plan out this very like mechanical like solution to the end, or you can just play through and experience it. But going forward, when we're having 8 scenarios, I don't think that's going to be the case as much anymore. It's not going to feel as like puzzly, like I do this and that's going to lead to this and that's going to get me to the best resolution.
Mm-hmm. Not until we're through the campaign a couple times, you know, not until we've seen every bit of it. Can we talk a little bit about Dunwich? Like, spoiler-free, obviously, just initial impressions since it's come out and since we wrapped up the Zealot discussion. Are we against that? Are we for that? Should I stop talking?
I'm for that.
I was waiting for an ample pause, but yeah, let's do that.
Those don't exist with me, Sean.
So, proper spoiler alert then, we're going to talk, I think, light mechanical and general impressions, light spoilers for Dunwich. We're not going to talk about like crazy resolutions or
no story discussion at least,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like it. I think it's a cool precedent for the way, I think when we saw the core box and, you know, assumed this was an LCG and it was going to work more like Lord of the Rings, where the core box then bled into the first 6 Mythos packs is what I think most of us veterans assumed. But then the fact that they came out with a deluxe straight out of the gate from the core, I think was a good idea in many ways because it keeps the core self-contained as a story and it doesn't leave you lingering when you've bought this core product that you have a completely unfinished product. And then at the same time, you also get a bigger influx of player cards straight off the bat with these new investigators that we got, which I thought was a brilliant move.
Yeah, Dunwich was great. I mean, I loved it. We played my first experience with it was a 4-player game on hard, which was fun. And I think we did MU first, and then we did Clover Club. And then I did a solo run through of both of those as Ashcan on standard. And I don't know if you guys have experienced this as well, but I think this just marks the difference between a 3-scenario campaign and an 8-scenario campaign. But oh my God, Ashcan on standard through Clover Club and then MU, easy peasy lemon squeezy. Like, I did not break a sweat. I only had to face 1 or 2 enemies. I was ahead of the agenda every turn. It was nuts. And I don't know if that speaks to Ashcan and Ashcan's Duke.
Just really good.
I think
Ashcan's just really, really good.
Because I wanted to do a solo run through with Zoe because she's my favorite of the Dunwich investigators. A, because she's Guardian, and B, because she's the tank. Like, Roland is quote unquote kind of tanky in the fact that you want him to be your vanguard. You want him to be out front in front of everybody because of the whole clue and action economy thing where it's like if there's clues on the location, he does better. So you want him to be on locations that clues haven't been taken from yet. But Zoe is like, the fact that Taunt exists as a card now, and Sean, in one of our games, I used it to, using that and some encounter cards, I was able to use it to pretty good effect. Like, that was awesome. Like, I love that Taunt exists. But I don't think Zoe... I wonder if it'd be as easy with Zoe versus as it was with Ashcan. Probably not.
It's not.
No, you've done it. Okay.
No, it's super not.
It's not.
The fact that Ashcan has so many bases covered and he's got that bonus move when you investigate, like he is just, he's so well-rounded. And I honestly think that it might be another thing here is now I've played it both ways several times because you can choose whether you want to do extracurricular activity, if you prefer. The house always wins first. I feel like it's easier if you do the house always wins first and then extracurricular activity, because I feel like dealing with the experiment is a lot easier that way, because you have an additional option that you wouldn't have if you went first.
That's one of the things I like about this Dunwich, is that whole which one are you going to play first mechanic is really interesting the way it plays out. But yeah, I've played it both ways. I don't think there's necessarily a right solution. It might depend on the investigator, but I think the increase in difficulty feels a lot more for Clover Club. Like, if you do it first, I've definitely breezed through it with certain investigators. And then if I've done it second, like, some investigators have just get smashed hard. Like, it's just a whole different experience. Yeah. But yeah, I've played it solo so far with Jenny, Ashken, and Zoe. And Zoe definitely had the most trouble for me.
Sure. Yeah, Zoe seems like far and away a team investigator. Like
She's a multiplayer investigator. Yeah,
I love her mechanics and I love how she plays, but I'm afraid to take her solo. So that probably means my next solo campaign will be her on hard. Because she scares me, so I'm gonna try it.
I think if you kit Zoe out with maybe Rosaries and Rite of Seeking.
Rite of Seeking, yes. Yeah, for sure.
That, I definitely have it. It's definitely hard to say because there was also a turn in my Chaos Bag fortune around the time I started playing Zoe. Where I had this terrible run of luck and player card draws and encounter card draws. There were pulls in a row that were fails, even though I was two or three up. So if anyone has any good suggestions for removing curses from their chaos bags, let me know.
Like I said in the last, like, just don't even play with the
chaos. You have a firstborn, right, Ian?
But
I had a really, really bad turnaround today. I was playing Rougarou. And oh my God, spoilers for Rougarou, because I really want to tell this story. So I was playing it with Zoe and Ashken. And the way I built those two decks is that they really are good at killing things and they're decent at gaining clues. So the whole idea is to make enemies less of an issue and then just kind of spend time getting clues. So Zoe was around the Rougarou's location, just kind of keeping her distance. And Ashken was off getting the fishing net because that's what he was meant to do. So meanwhile, Ashken got the fishing net and he was moving on to the last location that was out there that had victory points so that he could clear it of clues and we could then move in on the Rougarou and get the quote unquote harder resolution, the one that's on the back of the act. So Zoe then moves into the Rougarou's location, spends the clues to engage the thing, and then she does a fight to swing in with the machete. So the whole idea here was to get the Rougarou damage so that he would run away over to where Ashken was and then both of them converge in to get that resolution. So of course, that everything hinging on this idea. So move in, spend the action to engage, and then spend an action to fight. I draw the tentacle.
Of course,
as you do.
Yeah, why would you expect it?
As you do. As you do. So then the Rougarou retaliates. But luckily, I had been counting on something going wrong. I had a dodge in my hand, so I canceled that attack. But then, of course, the enemy phase comes around. Zoe was out of actions, couldn't really deal with anything from there. So she had to eat a full-blown werewolf attack. So two damage, ouch, two horror. And then,
three copies of Insatiable Bloodlust on it.
Well, okay. Yeah. Okay. So here's where we go from there.
Spoiler your story.
No. So of course that all goes wrong and I'm already pissed enough. So during Mythos phase, Ashken, who's the lead investigator, draws Insatiable Bloodlust. So that goes on the Rougarou. So I'm like, all right, frick. Okay. I'm going to have to use my last charge on leveled up Beat Cop to do a damage to get rid of that Bloodlust. All right. No, we still got this. And then Zoe draws Beast of the Bayou, which makes the Rougarou attack everyone at theirs in adjacent locations. So Zoe then eats a 3-3 attack, and it's like, oh my god, that was just like, there's the encounter deck couldn't have contrived a better combo than that for me right now, because I went from on top of it, resolution in two turns, no issue, to oh my god, I'm on my heels, Zoe's about to die from one damn token pull.
Yep. As you do. It's uncanny how the encounter deck,
it just knows.
Yeah.
It knows.
It knows. It can feel it watching me.
The funny thing is, the one time that I've achieved the quote unquote good ending with Rougarou, we didn't even use any of the traps. Like, it was Skids and Daisy, and yeah, I don't even remember how it happened because it was like 3 a.m. when we finished. But yeah, we got the good one, the good version of it. Didn't you have to use the traps? And I have never before or since been able to pull that ending. So that's a tough one, but it's fun. I think I think Rougarou is still my favorite favorite scenario when considering scenarios on their own. I think Rougarou is still my favorite.
Oh, Carnival is so good too. Both the standalones we have right now are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I could pick.
Yeah.
If I had gun to my head, it would be Carnival, but Ruguru is still goddamn amazing.
It's tough.
It is.
So, yeah.
It's there's something about when the map blows up to triple the size and suddenly it's like, oh, it's already in play. Like, it just enters the game, the Ruguru does. And now you gotta. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea that you're literally following its trail. And it doesn't mm-hmm. care about you. It just wants to do its thing. Like, it's so fun. And yeah, Carnival is awesome and it has its own rhythm and its own coolness to it. But for me, I think I almost like the first half of Carnival a lot better than the second half of Carnival, where it's, you know, you're paddling away and or whatever in the boat. Like, that first half with the circular map and everything, that seems so much cooler. Mm-hmm. I think I just want more locations is what it seems like.
The turn, though, like the turn and the story and the way the mechanics like fit exactly what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
My God, I loved that in Carnival so much. Yes. That was so cool.
It was very well designed. Like every level of each of these scenarios have been great. But yeah. I think for me, I love seeing a big area to move through and explore. And like I said, the minute, and I know you said it on this podcast, but the first time we played Knight of the Zealot at Arkham Knights and we set up scenario two, and I'm like, this is Arkham Horror, the board game. Like, this is the board mm-hmm. game in card format. And that's why I think I have played scenario two, like, on its own without doing one or three, just because it's my favorite of the first three. I just love those big maps. Sure.
So,
all right, well,
going back to Dunwich just for a second, I was going to say that I like both of the scenarios a lot, but the Clover Club really mm-hmm. hits it for me. Well, it's House Always Wins is the actual name, but I call it Clover Club.
Saying MU and Clover Club.
Just the way, I won't go into it too much because I want to preserve some of the spoilers for when we do an episode like this for Dunwich, but just the way it turns kind of existing ways of getting clues on its head and just yes. really hits that gambling and like club theme a lot.
Yes.
And I had a lot of fun with imagining Zoe going into this setting.
The funny thing is,
apron.
This den of sin.
Every time I've read through the Clover Club cards and played that scenario and everything, all I can think of is, and this was especially during our four-player game that we played, the first time I experienced it, Sean, but all I can think of is there's a game master behind the screen going, your party enters the tavern. What do you do?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go to the bar and drink. I'm going to go gamble. I'm going to go look around outside, see if I can find anything. And, you know, it's like,
and the GM's like, God damn it, they already split up.
Yeah, but it's so like, it's that's such a visceral RPG. It's straight up, you're in the tavern. What do you do? But I think I like MU or extracurricular activities better just because I like the Clover Club is really cool and it has great atmosphere, but I like the idea that it's like, you're in this place that people are regularly, like people move through Miskatonic University regularly and you know that there's something else going on and you're there after hours. And it's like, I love that sort of feeling of moving through the halls at night. Cause who as a kid going, whenever you visited your school outside of school hours, were you like, oh man, this place is actually kind of creepy when all the lights are off and all the lockers and halls and everything are just seem like they stretch on forever. And like, I thought that was, I like the atmosphere in MU definitely.
So it's a solid box is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Yes.
Highly recommended.
I would go buy it if you have it available. Sadly, it seems like FFG has been consistently underestimating the demand for its products, especially if you're into collecting Star Wars Destiny. It turned out it was more lucrative for me to buy a box of boosters from Canada than it was to try to find it anywhere in the U.S. So have that as a rule.
Wow.
That also speaks to the strength of the U.S. dollar right now, but is what it is. Anyway, so we've gone from a no spoilers podcast to a bevy of spoilers at the end. So hopefully that was a good change. If we ruined things for you, go ahead and come yell at us on Facebook or in the Discord. We're happy to hear the other side of the story as well. But yeah, so guys, let's move this into high and tight tentacle time. Nick, what's grabbing you recently?
As we talked about before the show, I did see in the interim since last we recorded, I did see Rogue One. I'm not going to go through my thoughts in detail on here. I did write a blog post on my blog, so nicholascorey.com. You can read about that there, Rogue One thoughts and reflections. In short, I liked it a lot. didn't think it was as good as almost everybody was saying. I did have some major and a lot of minor issues with it, but overall, it's a film that lives and dies by its third act, and that third act is pretty damn good. Other than that, what else have I been doing? Holy cow.
God forbid you ever just get excited with the rest of us, Nick.
I was excited. I was. I'm in this weird place with Star Wars. Like, now that Lucas isn't behind it, I both love and hate it. Like, it's like, sweet, we don't have crazy Lucas doing his super silly stuff anymore. But then at the same time, it's like, is it really Star Wars then? Like, is it really? Or is it just...
Yes, is the answer.
Is it just film versions yes. of Star Wars fanfic? Because that's honestly what the last two movies felt like in a nutshell. I'm not going to get into it in depth. Read my blog post. Additionally, oh, that's what else I want to talk about. Also on my blog, I am turning my game session that I'm my tabletop RPG via roll20.net campaign into a series of weekly blog posts where I basically just post my GM notes.
It's an exaltation of how awesome my NPC is when he runs through the corridor slicing everything up with his space katana. It's definitely worth a read.
Thanks for the endorsement, Sean. Yeah, I was as I was tooling through Reddit one day, and it seemed like a lot of the questions that were popping up, at least at that specific time, were all about like, how do you prep for a game? What does this look like? How do GMs deal with converting systems and dealing with this sort of player character and that sort of thing? So I was like, you know, I'm just going to turn my GM notes into a weekly blog post. And they're usually about 4 to 5 sessions behind my players. So my players can read those posts and feel, you know, nothing's really going to be spoiled for them. The first post is up. The second one is scheduled to go up today or tomorrow. I forget. So we've got like pre-session zero and then session zero character creation. But yeah, I mean, and then obviously the Roll20 game. Prepping for that. I spent some time yesterday evening getting ready for that. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm glad that everyone else seems to be enjoying it. We're just about to wrap up the first kind of story arc and jump into the second one. So that's exciting to see that kind of culminate. But that's really been it. Other than the couple games of Dunwich here and there, I really haven't dug into it as thoroughly as Sean has, or I'm assuming as Ian has. So.
Sounds cool. Definitely go check that out. Ian, you should join us in our little role-playing session.
No, I want to so bad.
And a free character.
If only my schedule can make it work.
Scheduling's a thing.
Yeah.
Ian, what's grabbing you nowadays?
A whole bevy of stuff, but I'm going to try to pare it down for the sake of brevity. The one quick mention is because I didn't get to say my love for Westworld on the last podcast because my internet got cut off. But if you haven't watched Westworld yet, please watch the season. It's so good.
We just finished episode 2. It's pretty good so far.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's
I can't say much more about it. Yeah, the first 3 episodes is a lot of world building. So even if you're kind of iffy up to those 3, once you push past those like first, I want to say maybe 3 or 4, it gets so deep and the characters start to develop. And oh my God, I just started it again. I turned it on in the background when I was playing some solo last night and catching everything that I didn't see the first time because it is so deep. It's like, oh God, okay.
Yeah, I definitely want to do a rewatch for sure. But the other bigger things, one is a reading suggestion. One is not a full novel. It's more like novella size, which is called The Ballad of Black Tom. This is actually kind of a remix, you could say, a reimagining of Lovecraft's story, The Horror at Red Hook, which if you haven't read it, it's kind of, let's say, one of the more unfortunate stories of Lovecraft in terms of racism, because it is set in New York City and kind of the narration about the inhabitants isn't the most enlightened. But what this modern author does is kind of take that and turn it on its head and introduce a new character into that same story to interact with that plot of Horror at Red Hook and those characters, who happens to be a black musician from Harlem, who's part of the title, Ballad of Black Tom, and kind of goes through how he eventually meets some of the main characters of that stories. And it's really good. It's very dark and deals with some real stuff. So be prepared for that. But I just find what the author did and kind of both paying tribute to Lovecraft and challenging him and creating a great story out of that, that speaks to a lot of things is good. And it's not that long. So I suggest people read that one. And let's see. The other big thing is I've just been on a huge binge of the show Critical Role, which is basically voice actors playing D&D. So that's kind of been my go-to when I have stuff to do and I just want something on, and been going through that. And that's kind of reminded me of how much I miss D&D and RPGs in general. So I'm going to try to find some way to get back into that, because it's definitely some of the most fun you can have in gaming. So
we have an open seat for you, Ian.
Yeah. I have to work some magic somehow.
Yeah,
those were the big things, I think. I'm trying to think. I feel like there's something I'm forgetting. Oh, I guess a short mention was game that is called Sunless Sea. I hope I'm not totally messing that up, but it's a game you can get through Steam. It's kind of a interesting steampunky setting if London suddenly fell through the ground underground and was next to a huge underground ocean, and you're basically having a crew and sailing across it. It's kind of like a mix of like the old Sid Meier's Pirates game and dark Lovecraft, and most of the time your character is gonna die, but they're descendant will pick up after them. So it's really cool.
Interesting.
Sounds like a great premise.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely,
is that
definitely
is
scratches
that PC
that
only?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
I assume PC only unless otherwise notified.
It most likely is.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, for my part, I have been playing and doing a lot of things since the new year came, since my job has slowed down a tiny bit. Hasn't slowed down as much as I would like, but enough to give me some time for thoughts. The one thing that I did pick up that I would recommend is a graphic novel series called Saga, which is really, really interesting. It's simultaneously fantasy and science fiction. It's got just such a distinct personality. It's about two soldiers on opposing sides of this long-standing war who fall in love and have a child, and the story picks up when they have the child, and literally the first line of the comic is the birthing mother going, "Am I shitting? It feels like I'm shitting." And that to me just it sets the tone for the personality of the comic so well. So I've picked up the first couple of compilations and I'm working my way through those, and I'm really enjoying it. I think the dust cover on the back says it really well. It's the kind of IP and personality that Hollywood wishes it could pull out right now. So anyway, really enjoying that. So I would recommend that to anyone who likes some anachronism in their fiction. But it's still really, really well-drawn characters and good art style as well.
I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. So that wraps it up for me. So obviously we'll check in with Tom and Scott next time we cast. Guys, so we'll start with Nick. Anything to add on our way out here?
No, not really. Night of the Zealot, guys. If you haven't played it, do it. Good.
If you haven't played it, you probably haven't listened this far.
Yeah, you're still waiting for the other Batman episode.
It's coming soon.
Yeah.
Ian, any closing thoughts?
Oh God, that reminds me. The other big thing was the Batman Telltale game, but I'm not going to go. Yeah, just play it.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Batman Telltale.
Fair enough.
Available for platforms everywhere. No, nothing. Pick up Dunwich. Pick up the Core. I don't know why you're listening to this if you haven't picked up the Core, but it's good stuff.
The other thing I will mention is we have, just through the generosity of some of our listeners and through the ineptitude of some of our hosts, picked up some extra swag and product to be given away. So we're still kind of convening on exactly how we're going to run contests to give that away. So pay attention to our social media. We've obviously got Twitter, Facebook. Probably won't announce anything in Discord, but I do think we have plans to give one of these prizes away live in Discord. So pay attention to it. So the next time we record, chances are we'll be doing one of the contests in that episode. So pay attention. All right. Well, I think that wraps it up for episode 10. 10? It's 10.
It's still 10.
It's still 10 of Mythos Busters. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will catch you next time.